Hi, this is Paul, and due to popular demand, Brett is back on the channel, and we're going to continue the conversation we had before. I was just mentioning to Brett that Len Vanderzee, who has been on the channel a couple of times, you know, wrote a book on the sacraments, and you know, part of the happy discovery that we're making is that these segments of the Christian church are not as far apart on the Lord's Supper as we once thought. And this is a very happy turn of events.
Yeah, and we were just sharing, I just shared a link with you from Word on Fire, so Bishop Barron's website, that picked up on our conversation in part of a larger conversation around Francis Chan and a rapper named Flame, I believe. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
I'm just looking it up. Yeah, Flame. Who's written a song on his newest album about real presence, and he's a Protestant. So Catholics noticing that Protestants are talking about real presence, and Protestants noticing that Catholic thought about real presence isn't maybe what they've been led to believe, right? So there seems to be this sort of movement towards greater mutual understanding on this question. And I'm not going to remember everything I said in the first time, so forgive me if I repeat myself. But at the beginning of my chapter on Calvin, I just note this like unmistakable pattern in the literature of a whole range of thinkers, Catholic, Reformed, Lutheran, Anglican, Baptist, pointing out how similar in many ways Thomas's thought on transubstantiation is with Calvin's own articulations of real presence, which strikes everyone who starts looking at it, but sounds completely implausible to people who haven't read Thomas or Calvin.
Right. Well, part of the issue is that the Reformed tradition has gone so many different ways. And one of the things, you know, what I was starting to say is that a denomination like the Christian Reformed Church always sort of feels itself on straddling these fissures that are opening up in the American ecclesiastical scene. And so some of them are sort of continue to drift towards evangelical. And so, some of those might be dispensational, more Zwinglian interpretations, while others find themselves over on the magisterial side, much more in alignment with Roman Catholics and Lutherans. And it's also the case that I just had a 2-hour conversation with Tom Holland, and he didn't know anything about the Jordan Peterson or that scene at all. And, you know, part of what I began to discover as I dug into this was that church plants, which in the 1990s were sort of planted with a seeker methodology, you know, a big sound, all of that, many of them have sort of naturally come over to weekly communion, more intentionality with respect to sacrament, greater intentionality with respect to liturgy, more appreciation for church fathers. You know, this is the church planting space.
Right.
Whereas a generation ago, it was, you know, it was something else that, we don't need theology. We just need to get people saved. And it's much more now understanding, you know, they need to be saved to something and saved from some other things.
Yeah, I think the early church had enough missionary zeal that if you didn't need theology to do the work of the church, they wouldn't have bothered, right? Like the fact that theology becomes immensely important, like, I don't know, by the time of the letter to the Romans, should tell you that you can't actually do evangelization and pastoral ministry for very long without thinking about what you're doing.
Yeah.
You're like, that's just right. And Christianity is in a certain sense a highly rational religion. It's always engaged in this sense that we can think this stuff through. This is right. There are times for appeals to mystery, but Christianity resists an over easy appeal to mystery to just dismiss the question, or we wouldn't have the whole tradition of theology, right? It's because from the beginning, when the word John chooses, right, in the beginning was the Logos, there's a sense that our minds are being engaged here. And Paul says things like, you know, put on the mind of Christ, or, right? Like, there's something about a conversion to Christianity that is an intellectual conversion as well. And we often downplay that. And of course, the danger for, you know, a theologian is to just have your faith all in your head and not in your heart. You know, that I'm not denying that that's a real problem too. But the flip side, the sort of anti-intellectualism has always been destructive of Christian faith, because Christian faith it claims to make sense of the world. And I think we have a great treasure to offer the world. We've got a lot of competing narratives that I don't find all that coherent. And I find Christianity gives us a coherent narrative. So let's do our theology, people.
So I thought our first conversation, you know, I never quite know when I talk to an author what I'm going to have on the other end of the line. And you were a delightful surprise in terms of, I think you have a real capacity to speak to lay people, and a real gift for taking what can become esoteric concepts and making them concrete and communicating them. And that's an unusual gift.
Oh, thank you. Well, maybe a couple things on that. I mean, one, we mentioned in the previous video that I work in a church office. And so it's interesting, not that I think I would lose this capacity if I worked in the academy, but working in a church office forces me, as I think I said, to do intro everything. So I'm constantly dealing with the questions as they emerge for the person in the pew, and not only as they emerge in academic journals, right? So I have to work on ways of articulating the intellectual richness of the Christian faith for people who are not professional theologians, right? And if I can do a little plug, I do this on a podcast too. I have a podcast called Thinking Faith that's got about 180 episodes. It comes out every Tuesday morning. You can find it on any podcast aggregator, you know, Apple or Google or Stitcher, those kind of things. So it's Thinking Faith with an exclamation mark. And I have a colleague here at the Archdiocese, Deacon Eric Goresh, who co-hosts. So if you've got, you know, podcast listeners out there, this is the kind of thing I do in my podcast too, right? I'm trying to answer the questions that a contemporary person brings to Christian faith, because I think, you know, it's a coherent way of framing. I think it's not just a, it's, I think it's the most coherent way of framing our experience of the world. I try to do that for a popular audience. And even the book that we're talking about, it's an academic book, but I try to write it so that an interested layperson who's not got either the pastoral work or the academic background might still find it interesting and useful.
Well, I think you succeeded. I was delighted by how clear many of the concepts were in the book. And again, I don't know if the title helps or not in terms of that element, especially for Protestants. I mean, we were talking before. I don't want to use the word branding, but words matter, and transubstantiation. We're not that far beyond hundreds of years of sometimes bloody conflict between Protestants and Catholics to not have certain triggers.
I think one of the reasons I wanted the title, I wanted it to be one word. There's a subtitle, but I wanted a one word title. And part of the argument I make in chapter one is that ecumenical agreements on real presence, which happened remarkably quickly and reached a remarkable breadth of consensus among a large group of Christians, Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant, came up a little short, and very often the concern was, but what about transubstantiation? And it would be the Catholics saying, have we sold out on this? Like, are we watering down our faith to do ecumenism? And Protestants saying, this sounds suspiciously like transubstantiation, but without the word. Are you trying to sneak us in, you know, through the back door here? What's going on? And so part of my argument in the first chapter is I walk through some of the agreements and some of the responses, because the responses to the agreements are often published. And I make the case that, like, the Christian people, because of the way the term has become an identity marker, both in its acceptance and its rejection, need to see it dealt with forthrightly if they're going to believe that the ecumenical agreements are legit. Okay. And so my whole thing is like, yeah, like, here it is. Deal with it. Like, if we don't talk about transubstantiation, all of our agreements about real presence, people aren't going to know if they're legit or not. Because Catholics know they're supposed to believe in transubstantiation, and Protestants know that they're not supposed to. But virtually no one knows what the word means.
Right.
They know they're supposed to believe in it or not. Well, that doesn't leave you a lot of room to work, right?
Well,
so I'm trying to crack that open.
The other group that I think we have to keep in mind are those for whom Christianity is itself not, you know, and that's been, you know, my channel, you know, whether or not Christianity is credible. And part of the problem with our context is when I say credible, all sorts of modernist connotations flood in, and we're thinking about apologists going back and forth about credible faith. But I mean it much in a much more pastoral sense of there was a book, or I don't remember the author right now, Take This Bread, written by a woman in the Main Line. Very, very interesting book.
Any chance it was Sarah Miles?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And, you know, in her case, you know, the sacrament, the Eucharist was, and even saying it that way, the Lord's Supper, that for her was a compelling entrance into the faith. She had all kinds of questions with respect to all kinds of things, but the Eucharist and the taking of it really, and it's a beautiful book, really sort of, you know, swoops her into the faith. And it's interesting in the wake of the Jordan Peterson moment, how many individuals, and I think for real reasons, were attracted to the traditions that were deeply sacramental, the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic.
And, right, right.
And lesser so down the way.
So I think, I mean, on the one hand, I'm speaking to Christians who have historically disagreed about the doctrines of real presence and trying to sort out where transubstantiation fits there. But on the other hand, there's kind of a two-pronged thing in terms of mission, right? So one is, as long as we're divided and fighting, we're less credible. So if you can clear up misunderstanding on any topic that Christians are divided on, that's good for mission. But on this one in particular, this is why I was so delighted with your read of the book that we discussed in the first interview. I'm not only trying to say, hey, Christians, we can understand one another better on transubstantiation. I'm also saying that transubstantiation is one thing that highlights a coherent Christian worldview that we can all kind of agree on that has to do with basic questions about the relationship between God and creation. It tells us something about who God is and how God operates in the world in light of Christian faith, which has application to a wide range of questions. You and I talked last time about providence and free will. Was one of the key ones, but there's half a dozen others that we could easily tap into, and I think we're going to talk about some of them today. The doctrine of creation, for instance, if God is in the system, this is the language we used last time, right? If God is one more thing among the things, then God is in competition with the things of the system, and so then an explanation like God created the universe or we can account for all of the biological diversity in terms of the theory of evolution. Those two things look like competing claims. But if God is related to the system as its foundation and the ground of its being, but grants to it in creation it the independence of its own working and laws and whatever, which is what Thomas calls primary and secondary causality, right? So primary causality is God's undergirding and keeping in existence all of creation. But secondary causality means that creatures are granted the dignity to be genuine causes. So any causation we can find in engineering or even in things like human psychology, but certainly in the natural sciences, that's legit causality. It's not, you know, there have been different theories, right? Like God actually does things in parallel or creates a universe that sort of wound up at the beginning to run according to what God knew we would choose. Because the question of how things are caused is actually a big thing in the history of philosophy, because you can't ever see a cause happening. You can see things, this happens, then this happens, but how are they related? That's actually pretty tricky to do. And for Thomas Aquinas, at least, creatures have the dignity of being genuine and real causes, which is not in competition with God being a cause. And he says things like, you know, God grants them, in God's freedom, God grants creatures the freedom to be genuine causes. We talked about things like that. But to go back to transubstantiation, to me it was a microcosm of that world where God holds everything that is in existence and makes things to be what they are, and also things are real and have their own independence and value and sort of power to do what they do, you know. And that just has a whole range of applications.
Well, and this is, you know, you don't have the opportunity to listen to my talk with Tom Holland because I just got finished with that and I haven't published it yet. One of the things that he was talking about was, we were talking about Islam, and he was differentiating between in Islam, God is so powerful in a sense that, you know, all our outcomes are directly attributable to God in a way that, let's say, and I think you just put your finger on it, between this primary and secondary causality. But then of course you have the split between those causalities, and the relationship between those causalities are going to be places in which, you know, obviously questions. And I think especially, you know, one of the things that I thought of a number of years ago was that in many ways the deconversion of the West was not so much a question of science, but a question of trust.
Hmm.
That it wasn't necessarily our thinking about things. It was how we felt about how things unfolded.
Okay.
And that's why I pitch certain things. You know, what is a Christian? A Christian is someone who trusts Jesus more than they trust themselves. Because there's always this hint that comes in that if I were orchestrating the universe, I could have avoided, let's say, something like the Second World War. Right. You know, and so therefore, because God didn't avoid the Second World War, God is therefore not trustworthy. And then we go off and imagine a universe in which we're looking for a more trustworthy God than, let's say, the one that we imagine represented in the Bible. So these questions of causality are, I think that's helpful. So maybe you can back up and we'll start. You gave me a nice list of things to kind of run through. Maybe we'll start going through that list.
Sure. I'll just add it, though, quickly in response to what you said. I mean, the story that it was science that was the problem, historically, is very interesting because, you know, we have a modern creation myth, right? Modernity starts with, like, I don't know, Galileo rejecting church authority on a scientific question, and the overturning of faith-based believing by reason, right? Now, I think prima facie, the biggest problem with that argument is that is not at all how Galileo himself understands the situation. That is only several hundred years later, in the 1800s, when people are writing books about the history of the warfare between religion and science, that they read the Galileo affair in those terms. Galileo himself never dreamt that his dispute about a scientific question brought into doubt the church's authority on questions of faith. Like it just never even occurred to him. But we read that now in an anachronistic way. We put that on Galileo. And if you look at all the major figures of the scientific revolution, none of them articulated what they were doing in the terms that we put on them now as sort of overcoming superstition, whatever. Vast majority were devout practicing Christians of one stripe or another. Newton is a strange kind of heretic, but he's still very devout. But people like Kepler or Copernicus or Galileo, these are all committed Christians who are not actually running into any crisis at all on this question.
Right. But even the way you framed it there, he was not challenging questions of faith. And so, you know, right there, it's in a sense framed as, well, now our world is sort of split. And I think it's in the, of course, Tom Holland, he sees that in the 11th century, you know, there's the seculum, and then there's, you know, we begin to have, actually the splitting does not begin there, but there's a division there, there's a split there that is obviously vitally important in terms of politics in Western Europe. You know, we're going to begin to have the church tell the king, you can't simply name the bishops and of course that won't be resolved in the 11th century.
Right.
But so right there, the lay of the land, we're always dealing with how to put this world together. And in terms of my conversations with John Vervaeke over in Toronto, who's sort of a post-Buddhist cognitive scientist, you know, one of the real divisions we have experientially is the fact that the stories which in many ways we imagine ourselves to be do not age. You know, there's something very Platonic about that, because our stories don't age. Our bodies age, our stories don't age. And so right there you have one of many different mappings of the eternal and the temporal, the space of decay and the heavens that do not decay. And of course, in the Middle Ages, you have that with, you know, with the Aristotelian worldview of all of the spheres. So these things map in a lot of different ways. And obviously then we have natural and then supernatural. And that nomenclature has, you know, given us all kinds of fits as we go on. So I think your idea of bringing this to creation, talking about causes and laying out, you know, Thomas's understanding of that, hopefully in a way that's accessible to us today, might help in some of these areas.
Let's give it a shot.
All right.
Yeah. So yeah, I read through the comments really, and then I wrote you sort of a series of like, well, here seem to be some questions that your viewership seems to have, at least judging by the comments. If you want to work off of those and just see where
go ahead. Go ahead. I've got them right here in front of me. So go ahead and start. I don't know if you have them.
Okay. Well, I've got you right in front of me. So let me go over to them. Okay. Here we are.
Okay. Some clarity about certain aspects of the historical development of Eucharist doctrine leading to ..
Right. Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that we didn't do a ton of work on the history that led up to transubstantiation, which is an important question, right? So some people think, well, there's different ways to approach it. Some people think, okay, the early church was ambiguous about this, right? Because some of the church fathers have pretty like realistic language, and some of them have like pretty symbolic language. And they'll read that as a kind of, maybe there was some controversy in the early church around this, right? And I had claimed that there's virtually no controversy until the 9th century. And it's interesting, if you want to go find the controversy, the sort of hero of the realist camp among the fathers is Anselm, and the hero of the symbolist camp is Augustine. Well, Anselm's Augustine's teacher. And we have literally no evidence of any dispute between them on the question. Furthermore, you can cherry pick symbolical quotes from Anselm and realistic quotes from Augustine and swap them, and people wouldn't know. You know, so we're tempted, living after the Eucharistic controversies, to read them back onto the fathers. But actually, there's literally very minimal discussion, like, in terms of, there's lots of discussion in the Eucharist, but it's not a controversial question. And that's why it doesn't show up at any of the early church councils or in any of the creeds, because those were dealing with things where there was real diversity and even heresy, which just doesn't occur until the 9th century, when you have two monks in France who are asked by the Emperor Charles the Bald whether Christ is present in reality or in figure in the Eucharist. And one of them, Redbertus, Pascasius Redbertus, says in reality, and the other one says in figure. And when you start looking at the details of what they mean, they don't sound as opposed as that makes them seem. And in fact, we have no evidence that they ever, like, published against each other or of any conflict between. They lived in the same monastery at the same time. They gave two different answers to the emperor, and not much seems to have happened. So even there, where it looks like there might be a controversy, there's no evidence of controversy. We just have evidence of two different answers.
What did they mean by reality and figure?
And this is exactly the problem. When Retramna says only in figure, he's denying basically a kind of physicalist interpretation. And so he says, well, obviously, like, if you look, you can't discern anything physically. Now, we don't have all of his writings. They're not all extant. And it actually gets confused, because later on his writings get attributed to someone else who was suspect of other heresy. So that led to a further controversy 2 centuries later. But basically, it is a question of defining your terms. One says, well, if what you mean by reality is this, then yes. And the other one says, well, if what you mean by reality is this, then no. That's slightly oversimplified, but that's the basis of their answer. And the problem is, Europe at the time was shifting into a new metaphysics. They were losing the Platonic metaphysics of the patristic era. And so what people meant by reality was just not commonly understood. And that's why Charles the Bald, the emperor, could even frame the question the way he framed it, right? I think I said in the last one, if Charles the Bald's question, is it present in reality or in figure, was put to the Platonist church fathers, they would have said yes. So it's a new metaphysics that even allows the question to be framed that way. We get two different answers, but they're not as different as they seem, because it hinges on definition. But 2 centuries later, something has happened. Retramnus's ideas have become suspect, partly because they get associated with John's Erigena. I don't even know how to say his name, but a relatively obscure Scottish theologian who is suspect for other reasons.
Let me just tell you something.
Okay, tell me more about him.
Well, I don't know a lot about him, but so in conversations between John Vervaeke and Jonathan Peugeot, so Peugeot is an Orthodox icon carver, and Vervaeke is kind of a post-Buddhist cognitive scientist. This guy comes up a lot, and I had never heard of him, so it's like...
Okay, I wish I knew more about him.
Yes.
But anyway, Retramnus's ideas get misunderstood as his ideas. That makes them suspect. Pascasius Radbertus's ideas that Christ is present in reality become more and more sort of carnal and physicalistic, which is not how the fathers generally talked. You can find some kind of carnal, but Paschasius starts, and because Retramnus comes to be suspect, Paschasian realism starts to rule the day, becomes more and more common, but also more and more sort of naive and disconnected from the tradition of the church, because with the new metaphysics, it doesn't know what to do with Augustine, for example. And so there's going to be a backlash. Someone who knows their Augustine is going to read this and say, this isn't the faith of the church. And sure enough, that happens in 11th century France. In Tours, a fellow named Berengarius is reading this Paschasian realism, which is becoming the dominant way of talking about the Eucharist. And it's got, you know, things like visions of children being carved on the altar. Like that's how far it goes, right? Berengarius says, well, this can't be right. This isn't how the fathers understood the Eucharist. This isn't how Augustine understood the Eucharist. And he pushes back against it. Now, Berengarius is right to push back, but Berengarius himself didn't have the metaphysics to actually give an Augustinian answer. So he gives what he thinks is an Augustinian answer, but it basically says Christ can't be really present, because actually just look at the thing. It must be some kind of symbol. And so the reality that the church has always affirmed moves from the elements themselves and God's action in the elements into the minds of the congregation or the communicant in Berengarius, right? Real presence is when we remember, and this, you know, prefigures someone like Zwingli, you know, at the time of the Reformation. Martin Luther, by the way, hates Berengarius, thinks he's a terrible heretic. Berengarius gets dragged to Rome and has to swear an oath that because he's suspect, he's teaching heresy. And he has to swear an oath in 1059 that says Christ is present in the Eucharist. And the adverb in Latin is sensualiter, which doesn't mean what we mean in English by sensually. Literally, it means in Latin, according to the five senses. Like you could discern Christ's presence in the Eucharist according to the five senses. Now, this is awkward because if you've ever been to Eucharist, you can't, right? Like that's not how it works. But it wasn't actually drafted by a theologian. It was drafted by a rather impetuous churchman by the name of Humbert of Candido Silva, whose other most famous act in history is dropping the writ of excommunication for the Patriarch of Constantinople on the altar of the Hagia Sophia, without necessarily consulting the Pope all that carefully first. So you have this sort of precipitous fellow, right? Drafts this oath for Berengarius that theologically just doesn't work. Berengarius swears it, goes back to France, recants the oath, says it was sworn under duress, and historians think that's almost certainly true, and continues the fight. But over the next 20 years, what we might call the Orthodox camp catches up with him. And they start to say, yeah, your critique of this sort of Paschasian realism has some teeth to it that we have to acknowledge, but your solution doesn't work. It's not nearly as traditional as you seem to think it is. And so after 20 years of back and forth, Berengarius is back in Rome and he's got to swear another oath. And this time it's been drafted by actual theologians. And the new adverb in Latin is substantialiter. And that's when substance enters the Catholic Church's thinking about real presence. And the thing about substantialiter is, substance is what is present to the intellect. So it's really real, but it's not discernible by the senses. You discern accidents, and then your mind perceives through the collection of data that your senses have pulled out from the accidents, computer screen, water bottle, book, right? But I don't actually see substance. So substance is really, really, really real. It's more real than accidents. I can change, I can get a haircut, I can get a suntan, I can chop off my arm, and I'm still Brett. My mind is clever enough that it can perceive that despite these changes in accidents, there's a reality there that persists, that's more real than my hair color or whatever else. And so this adverb works because it's talking about something really, really real, which is what the tradition wants. But it doesn't make the mistake of the previous one of saying it's available to the five senses. Because if it is available to the five senses, then you've got a real problem. You get things like, well, it's available to the five senses, but God is deceiving us. So God has put a veil over your eyes to keep you from being, you know, grossed out at the Eucharist. Thomas has no room for this. He's like, God does not deceive in the sacraments. That is not how it goes down. It's not deception for two reasons. One is because God tells you this is my body and he's not lying. So you have the word of God, which you can trust. So you're not being deceived. And on the other hand, what your other senses perceive are the accidents of bread and wine. And guess what? Those are really there. You're not deceived by that either. So Thomas will have no truck with this idea that there's God is deceiving us in the Eucharist. But that's a problem if you say Christ is present sensualiter, right? So substance enters the game here, and then it takes a generation or two before someone coins the term transubstantiation, which simply means, very literally, a change of substance.
This is all really good. I'm just taking notes as we go. I do want to go back, though, to the fact that, you know, if we read, let's say, in 1 Corinthians, you know, being the good Protestant that I am, you know, I know 1 Corinthians a lot better than Clement, but I can at least say his name. you know, the discussion around the feast, or mm-hmm. you know, it has obviously everything to do there except what the reformers and what these individuals hone in on. And so then the question is, you know, obviously in the historical accounts of the Lord's Supper that you'll find in the Gospels and obviously in the Gospel of John in particular, you seem to have an adapted Seder, an adapted, you know, feast with the disciples, connecting to Passover. And then of course the church moves over into the Gentile context, and leaving us this tremendous question: what did these Gentiles think that they were doing? Obviously, you know, and of course you've got overlap with the Jews and questions of exactly what was happening in Jewish communities flung throughout the Roman Empire in terms of all of what's happening in all these synagogues. There's just many questions there we can't answer. But it's enormously interesting how there was no fight of this until Platonism sort of recedes.
Right.
And of course, then Aristotle will come to the fore and Thomas will have to, you know, get to work. But anything more you want to say about that?
Well, So moving from a Jewish to a Gentile context is interesting, right? So Jews celebrating Passover have a, and this was actually enormously important for the ecumenical breakthrough, was looking at the Jewish idea of remembrance, right? So at the time of the Reformation, Zwingli says, well, no, it's just remember it. Like, it's a mnemonic device, right? And the Jewish sense of remembrance when you're celebrating the Passover is that God's saving acts are made present here and now, right? So when the youngest child asks the sort of patriarch of the family, what makes this night different from every other night? They speak in the present tense. They don't say what made that night, however many thousand years ago, different from every other night. They say what makes this night present. So in the Jewish understanding of Passover, God's saving actions are made present to his people today. And it was the rediscovery of that notion of remembrance, anamnesis in Greek, that was a big part of the breakthrough for ecumenical dialogue on are we just remembering or is God really present? Well, no, both. That's how it works in this Jewish understanding, right? As you move into the Gentile, and we don't have a ton of data on this, we do know not that there was dispute in the Christian community, but that outside of the Christian community, there were rumors that were spread about what the Christians were doing.
Right.
And Christians were accused of cannibalism.
Right.
Because of their language, right? So we know that the early Christians are using very realistic language about receiving Christ's body and blood at their meals, right? And I think it's Justin Martyr who writes, it gives us one of our best accounts of what an early celebration looked like, because he's writing as a kind of defense against these accusations to say, here's what we do at our celebrations, right? And he describes an early Eucharistic celebration. But obviously the language was enough to at least get some people, you know, wondering what these Christians were up to. On the other hand, the ancient world is full of like really bloody rituals.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Like if you want to get initiated into one of them, you like go underneath a rack and a bull is slaughtered on top of the rack above you, and you are literally drenched in the blood of the dying bull. So, you know, when people hear things about being washed in his blood, which is Christian language, but they have no idea what a Christian is or what Christians do, they're quite familiar with other, what are generally called mystery religions coming right. from the Middle East that do this kind of stuff. So we Christians tend to use a lot of language that sounds like that kind of thing. And then you show up and they're like pouring a little water on a baby's head and eating a cracker. And you're like, what? I thought
such
this was
a disappointment.
Like, this isn't even real religion. What are you people doing? You know? I mean, in some ways it's so subversive, right? That Christianity shows up in this place of remarkable religious diversity and with rituals that to us look bizarre and extreme, but they only look bizarre and extreme because we live after Christianity. Right. And then Christianity does these like little understated things like sharing bread with one another and using language about it that makes people wonder if they're being cannibalistic. Right. And it feels, when you describe it that way, it feels almost cheeky, you know, the way the Christians, but they weren't kidding with their language. They thought Jesus was really present and giving himself to them in this meal, but that it actually looks almost nothing like these pagan rituals, right? So there's some kind of subversion here in sort of the history of religion, that we find it hard to see because we're on the other side of it, right? But Christians were seen as very subversive. Not only were they called cannibals, they were called atheists.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, that if that doesn't tell you they look like subversives, I don't know what does.
Well, you know, Tom Holland in my, you know, sorry to have him, that conversation echoing in this one, but it's just the way my morning has turned out.
It's in your brain.
It's in my brain. You know, he talks about Christianity emerges as a consciousness of itself, as a parody of, you know, the Augustus cult. And, you know, it's a blasphemous parody. I mean, Tom used that word. I thought, that's an interesting word. It's a I'm terribly, I hope you get over your coronavirus soon.
you can't catch it through YouTube, you're fine.
That's right, we're safe. You know, he says, you know, it's a blasphemous parody of the worship of Caesar. And, you know, so a lot of the issues that I've been wrestling with over the last couple of years on my channel, you know, I found some of Owen Barfield's language to be helpful, of sort of original participation, then sort of a separated participation and looking for a final participation where, you know, you triggered it in me when you talked about, you know, the substance is what is present to the intellect, but not discernible to the senses. It's more real. And I've sort of been on the hunt for this language and a lot of these issues, because of course, part of what happens in the Protestant Reformation is a complaint out of skepticism and doubt about the corruption of the church that the Bishop of Rome would have effective access to the merits of the saints. And, you know, so you have all of these ideas about, well, you can't just, you know, you can't just smuggle out a wafer and is it right to think that we smuggle out a wafer and feed it to your cow if you have a sick cow? You know, because, I mean, the Protestant reformers are very much dealing with these issues.
Right.
And wrestling with what's going on. So I just recently read, really, it was a wonderful book, Fatal Discord, about Luther and Erasmus. And one of the turns that you see in Luther is that, you know, this becomes, in Protestantism, a deeply psychological turn. And so you have a fair amount of then separation, which of course will afford the Zwinglian posture. But now if we bring in a guy like René Girard, who is dealing with the psychological, and, you know, number of interesting things early in my talk with Tom Holland this morning, you know, talking about the nature of story, and obvious he's dealing with the classical period, but just the this stuff is so hard. You look at René Girard, and he sees this development away from a context in which you are being bathed in the blood of an animal, and animal sacrifice is a substitution for human sacrifice, and very quickly this is going to get mapped onto the Eucharist, which of course the Protestant reformers will get right. triggered about, and this will flow out in some doctrinal statements. So all of these movements in terms of what is real, what do we mean by this word, and at what level is this? Is it real in the sense that the story that is me is so real that it actually energizes my hands and my flesh and moves my car and all the way through? Is that the most real level? And of course later where no, the real level is going to be this virus that we can, that we can detect, that is willy-nilly, going into people, and we can contain ourselves and stop the plague, not by prayers in the church or the Eucharist at the table, but by monitoring the reality of these viruses and so on and so forth. I mean, these are all the issues that are beneath this.
Yeah, so a couple thoughts. So, I think what transubstantiation says, when you ask what's the most real, it is what God creates something to be is what is most real. I think it's a reference back to, right? And that's not reducible to the physical reality. But it is expressed in the physical reality and through the realm of the senses and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's part of the gospel for a contemporary age that a doctrine of transubstantiation is trying to teach us, right? So that I try to do that. I want to go for a little bit though, the giving your cow the Eucharist if they're sick. There's very legitimate concerns at the time of the Reformation that Catholics are approaching the Eucharist with a magical imagination, right? And I think Catholics can freely accept, we have historical evidence of, people burying in their fields, hoping for a good crop and like these kinds of things, right? We also have a major problem with Catholic Eucharistic practice, which is how often we receive it. So people stopped receiving to the degree, the church insisted people receive at least once a year. And what that ended up happening was it actually... some people started receiving at most once a year. And you mentioned earlier, that these church plants are moving to weekly communion. Calvin wanted weekly communion in Geneva, but the people were so used to receiving only once a year that they'd only let him get away with quarterly communion. So Calvin wants weekly. So now, today, many Catholics who would be weekly or daily communicants would think that these heathen Protestants only getting it, four times a year. you know, when you find out that that was a concession that Calvin made to the people of Geneva, who were mostly formed by the Catholic practice, never officially endorsed, in fact, quite misunderstood, but nevertheless, the practice of only receiving once a year, right? So there was plenty of room for critique on popular misunderstanding and even maybe misuse of the Eucharist. And transubstantiation becomes a shibboleth for that, right? It's the thing that stands for all this abuse.
Right.
And so it doesn't necessarily get dismissed as a theological doctrine so much as a practical, what are its practical outworkings, right? So that's one element of it. But I think another, and this goes to the question about sacrifice, if the Christian people did not have a fully developed sense of how Christ's sacrifice is somehow a subversion of the world's attitude towards sacrifice, right? So think of the Gospel of John when John says that Caiaphas didn't realize how true he spoke when he said, you know, one man should die for the people. Caiaphas has the world's attitude towards sacrifice, and he thinks he's sacrificing Jesus. And what the Gospel of John insists over and over and over again is that Jesus is above and beyond all the powers of this world, and he's actually sacrificing himself.
Right.
And that's woven right through the whole passion narrative in John, is that Jesus is actually the one in control. And even the people who think they're doing the sacrificing with their worldly understanding of sacrificing are not. You know, he can transcend as a creator who operates at a different level of causality, let's say, can transcend what they're doing without impinging their freedom and do something different even through what they're doing. And without impinging on their freedom at all, he is the one who's really making the sacrifice when they think they're the ones making the sacrifice. And which they don't frame in religious terms. They think this is a political sacrifice, which is very interesting, right? Because it happens outside of the holy city.
Yes.
This is
yes.
not a sacrifice in the temple. But what happens then the curtain is torn in two and says, actually, all this stuff was, in a way, all this stuff was political. There is no, right? There is no separation here. Like, Jesus is tearing down this false boundary and saying, this is what humans are doing to each other. If Christians lose the sense of the uniqueness of Christ's sacrifice vis-a-vis world religions, and think of it as just the best one, right? All the world religions are sacrificing to the gods, but this was the super goat. This is the best sacrifice. Rather than a subversion of sacrifice, as practiced in the world religion, then I think the Protestant rejection of the idea of the Eucharist as sacrifice makes perfect sense. If all this is a repeat of paganism, then we need to stop it right now.
Right.
If, on the other hand, we have a new form of sacrifice that looks like pagan sacrifice in some superficial ways, but actually undermines the whole logic of it. And we are called to participate in that. Then calling the Eucharist a sacrifice makes a lot of sense. So you know, you asked me earlier when we were talking about Paschasius and Redbertus and Retranus, what do you mean by real? Same thing here. What do you mean by sacrifice? Is the Eucharist a sacrifice? Depends what you mean by sacrifice. And if I'm a Protestant and I say that looks awfully pagan, then it shouldn't be called a sacrifice. But if I'm a Catholic who understands my tradition and says, this is an overturning of the economy of sacrifice in the pagan world, in some ways it's an anti-sacrifice, then maybe we've got something we can talk about, right?
Okay. No, it's really helpful. And I think... I think ecumenical conversations have made progress. I was at a Christian Reformed Synod where they were dealing with, I think it was question and answer 80 in the catechism, where they're dealing with exactly this point. And the the ecumenical interrelations team basically said, we haven't been reading the Catholic theologians fairly, and we're convinced of that. And so basically a recapitulation, this sacrificial system. But of course, you know, a lot of the language, I mean, in the front of my church, we don't have an altar, although people come into church and talk about approaching the altar, because of course, you know, you're trying to figure out, okay, what language game are we playing here? And why it's understandable why we don't understand each other and why people can quite innocently be confused.
Right. Right. Well, and here's a false dichotomy, right? Is it a table or is it an altar? Well,
yes.
Yes. But okay, look at the Last Supper, right? So you have a table and a meal where Jesus says, here are the interpretive lenses for understanding what's happening tomorrow on that cross. And I'm telling you that that cross is an altar. That's what he says at the table.
Yes.
He says that the cross is an altar. Yeah. Right? So, and that when you celebrate this, when you do this, you're connecting to that. Right. So this table is an altar. Like, don't make them like, and Catholics might want to go the other way. Like, Catholics think, well, it's not a table. You know, it's not just a meal. Well, it's not just a meal. But are you going to say it's not a meal? I mean, look at it. Right. I mean, any anthropologist from Mars coming, like, they're eating together. Like, what? Of course it's a meal. But even go back, you know, this is hard for us because our steak comes in saran wrap and styrofoam. If you've ever butchered an animal and eaten it, you know that every single meal is a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's how the world works.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's not an arbitrary connection.
Right.
It's a recognition of this of the cycle of life, right? Meals, like, tables are altars. And the almost universally human practice of ritualizing meals, praying, like different things we do with meals,
yeah,
tells you that this is not simply a biological function, right? There's something deeply human about the way we eat together. That if we ignore that element, like, why does Jesus spend half the Gospels eating? The Bible starts with a meal gone wrong and ends with a meal with a wedding banquet. I mean, like, if we think that meal, as Catholics who want to emphasize sacrifice, that meal's an inappropriate lens for thinking about the Eucharist, like, how much of it are we missing? You know, but of course we're going to say it's a sacrifice too. And
right.
And its understanding of sacrifice is intrinsic to its understanding as meal and vice versa, right?
No, that's really very helpful. Very good. I don't want to sidetrack us or derail us from your point. So.
Oh yeah, no. Let's carry on. You know, last time people said the talk was too short. So I mean,
people like long talks. Trust
me. My wife was just boggled. She read some comments. She's like, it hasn't been up for 24 hours, and there's people who've said they've watched it 2 and 3 times. Like.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah.
So hello to all the devoted YouTube watchers.
They're out there.
Well, they're out there.
Well, and you know, these, and this is again why I was so excited about your book and excited about these conversations, because I think when I was going through seminary, discussion of this would have been considered some obscure theological point that was unimportant. But for many people, these questions about, you know, what is real, what is reality, they have come to be the center of a lot of their existence. What is the meaning? What is the meaning of having a child? What is the meaning of fatherhood? And what stories ought I to live my story within? Because it makes a great deal of difference in terms of how I go about my life. There's, I think part of our difficulty is that our lives are short but integral into multi-generational stories.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, this, so again, with the, so I'm going to be in Thunder Bay in September at a conference in a place called Urban Abbey in Thunder Bay. And I'm going to be having public conversations with Jonathan Peugeot, this icon carver, and John Vervaeke, who's a cognitive scientist. And I would never have thought that something like this could generate interest or excitement, just like I couldn't imagine Jordan Peterson rambling for 2+ hours about the Bible would generate interest or excitement.
Right.
It was assumed that these kinds of conversations would be something that might excite academics, but not regular people who have regular jobs. And I think Vervaeke has the correct term in terms of a meaning crisis. I just read yesterday on Twitter, and I retweeted it, a very interesting book, which I haven't picked up yet because the buying of books, there is no end. And it's, as you well know,
my livelihood depends on it.
Yeah. basically a study that noted that, you know, in the United States, you know, the suicide rate amongst white men, including rates of addiction, you know, have risen dramatically since the 70s. And what's interesting is that it had been the case that the uneducated have, I think, my thesis about this is that the uneducated in the short term, out of the modernist fundamentalist fight, the uneducated at least had the church. And so the patterns that church life brought into their lives kept them sane and whole and productive and gave them meaning in the world. Some of what we've seen now is that religion has increasingly become the providence of the well-educated, which is an ironic twist.
Right. And it doesn't map onto the story we're told either.
That's exactly right.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, and what we're finding is that marriage rates for the working class and the lower class are plummeting.
Right.
Church attendance is plummeting. And what is increasing is what Vervaeke would call a meaning crisis. And this is very much what we saw, why Jordan Peterson took hold as he did amongst certain demographics. And I've come to believe that this is directly related to the conversations we're having now, which seems just sort of crazy, but I think it's completely true. And so just as, let's say, in the 9th to the 11th century, so Tom Holland basically thinks in the 11th century, you know, a dramatic turn took place that continued to reinvigorate the West. Vervaeke says that about the 11th century, when, you know, we began reading in a different way. Prior to it, reading had been more sort of a participation, and there was sort of a separation that takes place after Lectio Divina starts to fall off.
Okay.
And we begin to read in a different way. And I don't have the language or any of this figured out, but I think all of these things are connected. And so quite interestingly enough, we see ourselves tracking with what we think about this Eucharist meal, tying into all of these other levels, which again, where we're going in this ties into creation. But it seems like every number of centuries, which perhaps is speeding up, if we're going to understand what the church is doing and saying and meaning, not just in terms of a cognitive assent, but also in terms of a bodily participation, you know, we have to keep monkeying around with our metaphysic, because that keeps changing. And so the language which has been attached to it keeps having to be changed. And so then your book arrives and you're saying, yeah, well, Calvin was, you know, the language had flipped. And so Luther couldn't understand Aquinas. And And it gets to today, and it's like, yeah, there's some deep misunderstandings that are leading people into addiction and suicide. And the probably the way to correct it is certainly within our practice, but also within our language. Right. And how did we, you know, Jordan Peterson makes a comment at an Ayn Rand conference of all places that one of the things that he learned as a clinical psychologist was that it was people would only get better when he went to theological language, which is a fascinating observation.
That is, yeah. Well, I dumped a lot there. Yeah, no, it's so one thing I was thinking, right? So we started on this by talking about how long the video is, and it's in some ways, it's a reaction against soundbite culture, right? So we're told, you know, when you're preaching, keep it short. People only have an attention span of like 8 minutes, and then nothing sticks beyond that, whatever, which is true in some contexts, right? It's not completely false. But I think it's been overgeneralized. And people, you know, the kind of anti-intellectualism that comes along with that, whatever else, people find deeply unsatisfying. And if if you want to watch Netflix for 12 hours or play video games for 12, right? We have people who are willing to make money off us wasting immense amounts of time, right? That's not a problem. It is a problem, but it's, you know what I mean? So it's not surprising in one sense that in a reaction to that, you have people looking for substantive conversation and are willing to sit in on it for 2 or 3 hours. Yeah. I mean, because actually, what do you do? Like, what's a really good Friday night, actually?
That's right.
It's right. Like, it's not watching 6 hours of Netflix, but if you go out for a beer with a buddy and you have a really engaged conversation for a few hours, that's like, we're kind of built for that, right? In some ways, like, my wife and I are boggled because we have 7 children and we don't get 2 to 3 hours to watch anything. Like, we have to watch movies in half hour chunks. But as a cultural phenomenon, it does make some sense in light of the, like what's on offer, you know, like, obviously if a Christian Reformed pastor can just start a YouTube channel and talk to people for hours, and that can drive my book up the sales chart on Amazon, it's because there's something that people are looking for, right? Like, it's kind of surprising, right, to tap in and find out that people are interested in what you're interested in. But,
well, go ahead.
Yeah, but of course they would be. Like, you're not so unique and weird that no one would be interested in what you're interested in.
Right. Well, and I'm a pastor, and so pastors are these gateways between, you know, the academy and then also the people. I mean, we're always doing translation work. We have all this stuff up there that we put through a narrow funnel and try and get it out to the people in chewable sizes. We, in a sense, we cut the meat for the people. That's what we do. But what has happened is that things have gotten so bad for some individuals that this is a, you know, that these things have risen to an existential crisis.
Right.
And this should not surprise us. I mean, if you're going to go out into the desert and starve yourself, you don't do that just on a whim. You know, if you're going to sit on top of a pole, if you're going to sell all you have and devote your life to the poor, I mean, human beings have been doing this for a very long time. I heard, I was listening to, oh gosh, I hear so much stuff now. You know, an individual was talking about the fact that they were reading. This happened at a meetup. I've been on a meetup tour, and one young man, you know, calls himself a soft agnostic, was talking about. No, actually, this other one's going to church. I had a conversation with him. His name is Joseph, and he was raised Roman Catholic. Now he's going to a Missouri-centered Lutheran church in his neighborhood in Southern California. But he talked about the fact that he was studying history at the university, and he was studying the Reformation, And it occurred to him, you know, you're just kind of laying out the ideas. These are the progressions of the ideas. These are what the various people thought. And it occurred to him, now, wait a minute. These people are risking and suffering death on behalf of these ideas.
Right.
Nothing in the university class gave the participants of the class any participation
right
in that world.
Right. Those people must just be dumb and crazy.
Right. Or that's all those old people who used to believe in magic stuff.
Right. Except that people still die for ideas.
That's right.
Because actually, they don't die for anything else.
Yes.
You know, like, right? That's the kind of thing we are. Meaning makers, right?
But, and we don't understand that about ourselves because we've been told, well, we will die to make sure that there's food on the table. But that doesn't explain why we love our children so much or why we love a flag, this imaginative construct of a thing called a nation that we would give our life for it.
Right.
And it's something that's so deeply woven into our world, yet the dominant metaphysical system can't account for it.
Right. Right.
And so psychologically they're trying to scale up to it, but not so good. They only get a little ways. Well, I would die for my child. Well, why would you die for someone else's child? I can't quite scale the psychological mechanism up to that, especially since, you know, people abuse other people's children all the time. And so what we're seeing is that there's an entire fabric to making what we naively and quite rightly call a healthy society, you know, tons of stuff built into it, that we simply are unable to manage, even in our own little worlds. And so people have senses of angst, of anxiety. They try to medicate it with drugs, prescription, or illegal, or dull it with Netflix or something else. And they get to a point, and even those drugs don't work. And then finally, they have to resort to something as radical as religion, where they'll sit on top of a pole or give all their money to a YouTuber or on and on and on and on. And still we can't account for it.
Right.
That's where we're at.
Well, and the cracks in the system show up at some interesting spots, right? So if you look at demographics that have really bad like mortality rates, right? Like who dies, right? That will tell you what your society is willing to sacrifice. So who's dying in the opioid crisis? What are the mortality rates of sex workers? People in the pornography industry or who are trafficked in prostitution, I would say that's a form of human sacrifice. These are people that a culture is willing to discard, not because we say, oh, if we kill these people, then the gods will be happy, but to satisfy some idea. There is some idea, right? Something about our sexual fulfillment or freedom or whatever. That's bought with a heavy price. I mean, one really interesting one, I remember, you know, I was a little guy growing up watching professional wrestling. I remember when I was in undergrad, a news story broke that some professional wrestler had died, you know, maybe in his 50s, like as a relatively young man. And I thought to myself, I feel like I've heard this story before. So I went and tried to look up a bunch of wrestlers that I had grown up, you know, watching or at least familiar with. And it is shocking how many of them are dead.
Wow.
Well before their time. And you think, well, what is going on there? So then you look at the life of a professional wrestler, right? So yeah, I'm a Canadian. My name is Brett. The one I would know the best is Brett the Hitman Hart, who got his head kicked in and is suffering from long-term consequences from post-concussion syndrome and whatever. And the stories they tell about people working 300 plus days a year, living on painkillers because of their work, like doing outrageous sort of stunts and, you know, everything that comes along with that lifestyle of being on the road and whatever else, of course they have a terrible mortality rate. Prostitutes and professional wrestlers and other groups that have ridiculous mortality crises, mortality rates, to me, point us to who we're willing to sacrifice and what are the ideas we're willing to sacrifice them for. You know, what are we doing when we're watching professional wrestling, you know, where we have people who can punch their boss in the face and, right? Like, it's a place where we're dealing with our own angst, but those are real people who are dying at stupid rates, you know? Yeah, yeah. And same with prostitution, right? Those people die at stupid rates so we can get rid of whatever we're getting rid of, offloaded on them. So I think this is all part of this crisis of meaning, but it goes back to sacrifice. And what would you be willing to die for, or what would you be willing to kill someone for, or at least let someone else die for, you know?
Yes. Well, let's get, so your second point, some particular investigation of Thomas's doctrine of the Summa, particularly the sections where he compares transubstantiation to first consubstantiation and annihilation replacement theories, and then to natural change and creation ex nihilo, which will then lead to his doctrine of creation. So really curious about how this works.
Okay. I'm grabbing a cough candy.
Yep.
You noticed I'm
won't cure coronavirus. Nice to know. Glad we're getting this video in. I shouldn't joke.
So if we look in more detail at the Summa, Thomas does this sort of, you can't speak about transubstantiation super directly. It's a completely unique thing. There's nothing else like it. But what we can say is, here are some other things that we can say, we can compare and say it's like and unlike in this or that way, right? So when transubstantiation first emerges, pardon me. When transubstantiation first emerges, it's not particularly clearly defined. It's a change in substance, but what does that mean? And so consubstantiation and annihilation replacement theories are ways that it was initially potentially understood. Theologians had different ways of thinking about it, and it wasn't official which one was the right one. Consubstantiation says the bread and the wine, the substance of the bread and wine, because of course the accidents do. Consubstantiation says the substance of the bread and wine persists through the change. So the substance of Christ's body and blood are added to the natural substances of bread and wine. Annihilation replacement theory says the substances of bread and wine are sort of, they're annihilated, they're destroyed, and then they're replaced by the substances of Christ's body and Christ's blood, right?
And we have to keep remembering substance here does not mean what most modernists like you and I assume substance to mean.
Right.
It goes back to that definition you had before.
The deepest reality that is what God makes something to be, that is present to the intellect.
Right.
But it is not reducible to the physical reality, even though in normal terms, we apprehend it by our encounter with the physical.
Right.
And there are non-physical substances like an angel or something, not just non-physical, but without physical, you know, elements to apprehend. So annihilation replacement is one possibility. Consubstantiation is another. And Thomas says neither of those are adequate because on the one hand, he lists a bunch of metaphysical absurdities, right? So if it's annihilated and then replaced, there has to be some minute fraction of time in between when there's nothing there, and that's absurd. Consubstantiation is absurd because you can't actually have two substances present in the same accidents in the same way at the same time. So it's metaphysically absurd. But I think that's not the most interesting part of it. I think the most interesting part is the theological rationale, which is something like, look, what is the economy of salvation? Does God destroy creation and replace it? Does God leave it as is and just layer something else on top of it? Or does God work to transform it from the inside out? And it's a kind of sense of the salvation historical movement. It's really an eschatological
right.
kind of claim, right? That that what right. God is doing with creation and saving it is a genuine transformation from the inside. So it's interesting if some of Luther's language at least sounds like there's not a genuine change in the inside. It's just God, you know, looking at you as if you were different, but there's not that's the real, you know, moment of grace is God kind of pretending that you're or not taking into account your deep sinfulness rather than a change. That's an interesting parallel with consubstantiation, which leads to bread and wine intact, right? So that's one element. So that's one reason why Thomas opts for transubstantiation. On the other hand, Luther also has, if we can skip ahead to Luther also has a theological justification for consubstantiation. He says, on the one hand, from a metaphysical point of view, he thinks it's more compelling because it requires less superfluous miracles. Now, Thomas said it was only one miracle, but later articulations had sort of multiplied the miracle claims. So he thinks metaphysically it's easier and simpler, but he also thinks theologically consubstantiation makes more sense with reference to the incarnation, where Christ is fully human and fully divine. So why can't this be fully bread and also fully the body of Christ? Right? So he makes a theological approach as well. What I argue in the book is that there is a parallel with the incarnation, but that a human person is a different kind of thing than a piece of bread. A human person has an eternal destiny, and a piece of bread has an end, which is to become a body. So a fulfilled human is still fully human, but fulfilled bread is actually transformed into body. That's what you do with bread. Whenever you eat it, you're turning it into your body. So I think there's still room for an acknowledgement of the layer that Luther wants of the right, that it's not a destruction of the created reality or an ignoring of it or a leaving it behind, because we think Christ's humanity is elevated. I mean, it's the best humanity. And so there's a sense of elevation even in consubstantiation if you want to follow the logic of the incarnation right through. But then I say, you know, if Thomas could respond to Luther, he might say, yes, and bread also is meant to become a body. There's a dynamism, an eschatological dynamism in the Eucharist that makes transformation from one substance to the other rather than a simple layering of them the more adequate way, you know, to think about it. But Catholics have also said, including, you know, Pope Benedict XVI has said, if what you really are trying to hold on to with consubstantiation is an insistence that the bread and wine are not an illusion, that they're genuinely there and sacramentally valuable, then that's not opposed to transubstantiation at all, actually. What Thomas is trying to do with the accidents is to say just that. You know, he's not saying they're nothing. But by the time you get to Luther, he thought, you know, that transubstantiation did imply a deception. That had crept in between Thomas and Luther. And so several things that Thomas said, you know, was very clear on, were muddled by the time it got to Luther, which made consubstantiation more plausible. So that's one. And in fact, the transubstantiation that Luther was familiar with was actually an annihilation and replacement theory, which Thomas had explicitly rejected. So that's one set of comparisons Thomas makes: is transubstantiation, consubstantiation, annihilation, replacement, to gain clarity. But a second one that he does, which I think will lead us somewhere interesting, is there's different kinds of changes. And transubstantiation is a unique kind of change. It's not like either of the other two changes, but it's like each of them in some ways and unlike them in others. So he compares it with natural change on the one hand, which we might call transformation, right? like eating a sandwich or burning a door or anything. Like, you and I can change one substance to another. We do it all the time, right? Like, if you're a carpenter, you can change a tree into a chair. Now you've just taken some matter and given it a new form, and now you have a new substance. That's a natural change, a natural transformation. And the other one is creation ex nihilo. And Thomas says, creation ex nihilo is not even a change, properly speaking, because there's nothing, literally nothing, that changes. But it is like transubstantiation in that it is only accessible to the power of God. So he wants to pull our imaginations out of a natural change. He says it's like natural change in that before you have one substance, but after you have a different substance. And that happens all the time in the world, naturally and through human engagement with nature. And that's a normal thing. Transubstantiation is like natural change in that you have two terms, a before and an after. But it's like creation ex nihilo in that it is unimaginable, right? You like think about creation from nothing. You can't imagine nothing. You can imagine some big black empty space with a pinprick in the middle that explodes or something, but you can't actually imagine nothing. And he says in the same way, he has this really interesting phrase. Could you imagine what it would mean for this finger to be that finger? And it just shows you how crazy the idea, no, what would that even mean? Yeah. I don't mean, could I pull this one off and pull this one off and switch them around and put them back on my knuckles? I mean, this actual finger, but it's that finger. Like, what is, you know, right. He uses that just to show us how unimaginable creation ex nihilo is. Not to say it's unintelligible, which is a very different thing, right? He's saying it's unimaginable. There's no images for us to put to it. And he says transubstantiation is like that. The power of God can act to make a thing to be. If God makes everything what it is to be what it is, then he can take any element of that creation and say, this is my body. Now, it's not arbitrary that he chooses bread for reasons we've discussed in the history of the Jewish people, in the natural symbolism of food and its relationship to bodies. So I'm not saying it's arbitrary, but on the other hand, but it is an element of creation that God is already creating. From creation ex nihilo is not something that happens at the beginning of time. Creation ex nihilo is what's happening all the time. All of us are being held in creation. And at any moment, if God stopped holding us in creation, we would be nothing. We are nothing without God holding us in being. So God is holding every piece of bread in existence in being right now. Everything is being created now. And so an element of that creation, which is being determined by God from the outset, can be determined by God in a new context to mean and be something else. And the words of consecration are important, right? So God creates by his word, let there be light, right? Which is different than how the other gods create. The other gods create by killing dragons and making people out of their guts and, you know, things like that, right? This God creates peacefully and by his word. It's a non-competitive relationship with creation. He doesn't have to wrangle it under his control. He's not on the same level of creation where he might have a rival within that could. And so bread offers no resistance to God. When God says, this is my body, bread says, ah, just what I was made for, you know? Human sinners are a little trickier.
Right. We offer resistance.
God says to the church, this is my body. And we say things like, well, let me go bury my father first, or, you know, whatever the kinds of things that we say. And so we're more of a work in progress, right? Whereas the Eucharist, it offers no resistance to God's creative intention for it, and just sort of rests in its identity of what God makes it to be. But you and I, sinners, you know, we wrestle with our identity as children of God. And sometimes we do better and sometimes we do worse. I mean, this is Israel's name, right? The one who wrestles with God. But bread, not so much. Bread says.
Well, you know, it's, you know, earlier your conversation about magic, and I mentioned this book, and I mentioned it to Tom Holland. I'm an inveterate book salesman, it appears. You know, I push your books, I push Tom Holland's books.
We all appreciate it.
But, you know, the entry of the question of magic and your primary and secondary causes is helpful because, of course, in Kaufman's distinction between, let's say, a meta-divine realm out of which gods emerge, you know, the meta-divine realm itself then becomes a place of potential magic because whoever has, in that sense, the best technology of the meta-divine realm can accomplish that which is according to its will. Whereas his argument is that in the Jewish conception and inherited by Christianity and Islam, there can be no magic as such because there is God. There is no other thing above God towards which God must obey, that which God exercises power, elements in order to manipulate. And this gets very interesting with these ideas about substance. I mean, when you say, you can change one substance to another, you can turn a log into a bench, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you go into, it's just amazing listening to you talk and thinking about, let's say, Jordan Peterson's conversations with Sam Harris. I mean, Peterson is dealing with a lot of these things as he goes in terms of these questions. I mean, when does a glass become Elvis's glass or Elton John's glass? I mean, there's no difference in the materiality of the glass, but right. You would argue that the substance of the glass has changed by virtue of the word of Elton John when he says, "This is mine." So
that's interesting, right? So it's a slightly metaphorical use in one sense, because Elton John can't say that this glass is not a glass, it's my body, he can't.
But he can tell everybody that this is my song.
So there is something,
John.
There is something that humans do in human culture that is genuinely real in a certain sense, that Catholic theologians tried this in the last century. So they tried to say transubstantiation is unavailable to the modern person. It's got, this Aristotelian trappings. Let's look at our contemporary metaphysics. So they look at things like phenomenology and that sort of thing. And they come up with a couple ideas called transignification or transfinalization, which they say, so let's take a metaphor, right? You and I belong to a nation. Well, we belong to different nations, but let's say we belong to the same nation, right? Where we've all agreed that a certain rectangular piece of cloth with a certain color pattern on it represents our nation. We cry when people raise it on a pole and play a song. We get incensed if someone tramples on it or burns it, right? And that's not crazy. I mean, it might be crazy in some contexts, but in general, it's not crazy that a symbol representing our community would evoke those kinds of things in us. There's something genuinely real that we have done in our agreed communal meaning making. Our great artists do this all the time, creating meaning out of story and symbol. And it's not real. It's like anyone who's ever been touched by a novel or a poem or a painting or anything, right? This is genuinely real. And the church, the Catholic Church, said these articulations work with a caveat. They work if we understand that they are not replacements for transubstantiation, but aids to understanding it or other angles at approaching the mystery. So the danger is this: transubstantiation begins with God's creative action as the foundational metaphor for understanding it. These other things begin with the human creative capacity as the foundational metaphor for understanding them. The human creative capacity can tell us something true about God's creative capacity, but it can also falsify our understanding because it doesn't reach right down to the depths the way the metaphor drawing from creation ex nihilo does, right? It's still like we made it this way so we could all agree otherwise. And it could be like, and so it said, the church says these things tell us something true about transubstantiation, but they don't replace transubstantiation and its foundational metaphor of God as creator, which is in some ways like what humans do when they create meaning, but is in fact deeper and more real than what humans do. This is really interesting. There's a line in the Fourth Lateran Council, 1215. And Lateran 4 is the first council where the word transubstantiation shows up. But it's ill-defined. This is before Thomas. It's not defined here. It's just sort of thrown off in a discussion about something else. It's not part of what's being defined at Lateran 4. But the word shows up. But the most important teaching of I said Vatican 4, didn't I? Lateran 4.
No, you said Lateran 4.
Okay, Lateran 4. The most important teaching of Lateran 4 is that we can speak about God using analogy, but when we do so, the analogy always fails more than it succeeds. And so we should recognize that while we can say intelligible things, we will always miss the target by more than we hit it. And I, like that applies not only to transignification, it actually applies to transubstantiation as well. Right. But what the church says is that transubstantiation hits a little closer than transignification hits. But they're on the same kind of continuum. They're not opposites. They tell us something true about the Eucharist and about God, but they're also inadequate. Trent has this really interesting line. It's one of the only places I'm aware of this ever. Well, it's the only place I'm aware of this happening in the history of church teaching. It calls transubstantiation the most apt, aptissime, the most apt way of speaking about the mystery of Christ's presence in the Eucharist. Now think about that. Built right into Trent's definition is an acknowledgement of the limits of language. It's saying this is, it's not saying this is absolutely true. Well, it is true, but it's not exhaustively true. And it's not true in such a sense that you couldn't learn more or explore other ways of thinking or speaking, which leaves room for ecumenical discussions. But it does say it is most apt. So it becomes a definition of church teaching that this other church teaching is an apt church teaching. It's a very bizarre kind of thing, but built into that kind of pronouncement is a recognition of the limits of our language for talking about this kind of thing, right?
Well, and it's very strange. When, I mean, and you say, well, you know, here we find transubstantiation in Lateran 4, and it's ill-defined. Well, that in and of itself is interesting. And here's this word that we sort of, okay, well, we're grappling with this stuff, not just inside our own heads, but between us, together, sometimes separated by great distances, the, you know, mediated by language, you know, marks scrolled on paper, and so here's a word. Let's use this one. Let's call it transubstantiation. And all right, we're not quite sure what it means, but we'll all sort of agree that that's the best we got now. And Thomas right. will look at that and say, yeah, there's real problems with that. So he'll work on it some more. And then all the way to Trent in the middle of this, you know, the Church of the West is seeing the kind of insurrection that now it no longer has the political capital to put down as it had in years past. And well, we've got to get together and come up with something. So this is the best we got, but at least in all honesty, acknowledging it's the best we got.
Right.
And,
right.
And then you begin to get the sense of, yeah, what really strange creatures we are. And also a little bit of humility about language with respect to, I mean, part of the, I don't remember who said it, but You know, we are told to do this. We are not told to, you know, to understand it. And then to me, that sets us back at a question, say, now why exactly are we so motivated to understand it as much as we are? What down beneath us? Because we're hoping if we can understand it, we're probably hoping if we can understand it, we can colonize it and we can wield it. And, you know, very quickly we've got an idol there.
So one of the things that Protestantism has historically been concerned about with transubstantiation is it seems to over-explicate the mystery. So I said earlier, Christianity is not, especially in the West, has not been super satisfied with it's just a mystery. On the other hand, there is a danger of pretending something is much more understandable than it actually is. And so one of the things that transubstantiation, I think, properly understood does is it locates and protects the mystery. And it does it by clearing away misunderstanding. So one of the things that happens, right? So in the early church, we don't have debate about this. But once the question is raised about the coherence of the church's claim that Christ is really present, right? When someone like Berengarius says, well, just use your head. He can't really be present. So it must mean something else. And Luther faces the same problem with the Reformation with Zwingli. He just says, well, it just can't be what you're saying because just look at it. And Luther says, no, the Bible, first of all, but then the whole tradition of the church has insisted on this. So it must mean something. And once the question of its meaning is raised, either by Berengarius or someone like Zwingli, then the church has to answer that, right? That, like, it's fine to truck along until someone raises the question of coherence. But once the question of coherence is raised, you have to answer. And the temptation will be to over-explain and pretend you know more about something than you do. And so what I think transubstantiation does well, it's this kind of via negativa, right? So it's not consubstantiation, it's not annihilation, it's not natural change, it's not creation ex nihilo. Here's a bunch of things it's not. And it's not them in this way and in that way and in this way and that way. I can label very specifically lots of things that it's not, and I can find language like substance, which at least says something that shows that this is not an incoherent claim, right? When we have the adverb sensualiter, Berengarius is dead right to say this is incoherent. This doesn't work. And so transubstantiation, but other doctrines, if we could think about the Christological doctrines, if we wanted to do a deep dive in early church history and talk about the development of the language that leads us to the Trinity and, you know, one divine person, two natures, all that kind of stuff, it's doing the same work. And the work is, this is not incoherent. It's meaningful. The gospel we're preaching has genuine content that interacts with what we're saying about the world. And so we clear away the questions that would say, this is nonsense, this is gibberish, this doesn't make any sense. You know, what we know about the world tells us that your language is absurd. No, what we know about the world doesn't show that this language is absurd, and here's why. That's the work that theology is doing in both the case of Christological doctrine and Eucharistic doctrine. But it never says completely in every case it has to say, like, how is this possible? When the answer in the end is, by the power of God, then you're in the realm of mystery, right? Then you're in the realm of mystery. But you can't say something like, the tradition has always insisted, you can't say something like, here's a four-sided triangle. Well, how is that possible? By the power of God. No, because the idea is incoherent. If I can show the idea is not incoherent, then I can rely on an explanatory power of God. But it is incumbent upon me to show that this isn't just nonsense. And that's what's going on with transubstantiation and other things.
That's really helpful. Now we're pushing on 2 hours here, which doesn't really surprise me. and I want to get to, and I don't know how much justice we can do. We can always talk another time, but sure. I want to get to point three, reflecting on Thomas's doctrine of creation, and particularly on the distinction between primary and secondary causality, which goes both to the question in the comments about God being in the system, about which there seems to be desire for further conversations, panentheism. Some of the people really, that they're begging to get me to say that word. And now my stubborn Dutchman I'm gonna hold him out as long as I can, to questions about creationism and evolution, because the big theological problem with creationism or intelligent design is that it imagines a God that operates only in terms of secondary causality, i.e. a God that is thoroughly in the system, which is precisely why creationism only becomes a thing in modern Christianity.
I made a kind of offhanded comment about evolution last time, and there was some
that word will get you comments.
Yeah, right. But I mean, it's with we didn't explore it to a large degree. We looked at providence and free will, which is really interesting. And some of the comments thought that was some of the more interesting stuff we did. Like that understanding God's relationship with creation in light of a doctrine of transubstantiation gets you a God outside of the system, as we said, which goes a long way to resolving sort of false dichotomies on free will and predestination. Or just God's providence. In terms of creation and evolution, it's really interesting, right? Thomas has a few lines that look remarkably like a theory of evolution, because he says something like, God puts a certain intelligibility into creation, but it works itself out over time. Even St. Augustine actually is often quoted as a sort of early proponent of evolution. It's directly in Thomas's language about God's relationship with creation and the relationship between primary and secondary causality, that God puts into creation its own dynamism, its own sort of basic rules and that play out. And when God is in the system, then God is up against those rules. So then something, right? So one of the problems with creation or evolution is it how it relies on chance, right? Which is somewhat analogous to the question of freedom in the freedom and providence question, right? Could God have intended to create Paul Vanderclay? Because that's Christian belief, right? God intended you. God wanted you from all time and left it to chance. Not if God is in the system. Right? Then God who only operates at the level of secondary, what Thomas calls secondary causality, can't do that, because chance might go wrong and do something that God doesn't know about or can't predict, and then therefore produce results that are contrary to God's will. And so then we have a big problem. But if that's not how God's causality is related to causality that he has endowed creation with, then you don't have the same problem. So imagine this, right? I play board games with my kids. There's a board game called, any board game will do, but there's a board game called Settlers of Catan, where certain numbers generate better. You want your settlements on sixes and eights.
Right.
Because sixes and eights hit more often than ones and twelves, right? Now, when I roll the dice, It's genuinely random from within the system of the game. It's genuinely random.
Random enough,
right? I'm not controlling it, that it produces more sixes and eights, than ones and twelves. But it's built into the system. And over time, I'm not going to roll more twelves than eights. I might over the short period. But what that means is that I can set parameters. As a human, I can set parameters within which genuinely random events can generate predictable outcomes. I can do that as a human being. Because I'm operating at a different level of causality and intentionality than dice are. If I can do that, God can do that, right? Like, you know, Einstein, I think, said God doesn't roll play dice, right? Well, God can play dice if God has set a context in which certain roles mean certain things, and they can still be genuinely random and generate predictable outcomes, right? And so that's just a metaphor from within human experience that shows some difference between primary and secondary causality. Of course, that breaks down. It doesn't get all the way to what God can do, but it shows that what we're claiming about God and creation and evolution is not impossible, right? If the concern is God needed Paul Vanderklein, he wouldn't leave that to chance. The answer is God is big enough that God can use genuine chance. It's really chance. It's not a fudge to get Paul Vanderklei if that's what God wants. And that's possible in the patristic idea of God. It's explicit in the medieval and Thomistic idea of God. But when that breaks down, and in the late medieval period, God comes into the system, and we go through this in the book. Someone in the comments mentioned Hans Boersma's book, Heavenly Participation, which is actually quite influential on my first chapter. So nod to the listener who picked up on that one. He shows, and I use him and others, including James K. Smith, who I think you mentioned, and also Bishop Barron, who we've mentioned, they also show up in the bibliography, to show the breakdown of this medieval idea of God, which leads to a modern conception of God where God is in the system,
right,
and God is competing with our free will and the question we dealt with last time, but now competing with genuine chance or randomness, yep, in creation.
Yep.
And so what you get then in a modern approach is, well, let's say that the evidence for evolution is so overwhelming, I can't deny it at some level, but I'm going to say, there's one thing that you couldn't, it's just too complex. It's irreducibly complex. I can't explain it with evolution. So God has to get in and tinker with the system,
right,
in order to make the eye evolve or the flagellum in our cells, or, you know, there's different things that are proposed. That's a completely modernist conception of God. A God who cannot work through the genuinely random, but has to overrule it at various points to make it work.
Right.
And Thomas's answer is just like, no, God's bigger than that. God is so free that he can let you be free and you won't wreck his will. God is so free that creation can be genuinely random and not wreck his plan. Right. And even from a historical point of view, the emergence of creationism, as we understand it, it's post-Darwin and it's post-historical critical study of scripture. It's a reaction that lots of people, the story we tell is the whole world was creationist and then Darwin came along and wrecked it, and some Christians accommodated themselves to that and some held fast. And that's a story that's told by atheists and it's told by creationists. They agree on that story. But I think the historical story is actually, this question was never put to the early church in the way that a modern person puts it. The fathers did not concern themselves with it, but the picture of God we have in Augustine and Aquinas has no difficulty with evolution. And creationism emerges not all over the world, largely in the United States. Really, it's a particular cultural construct too, in response to a couple of contemporary scientific and historical developments. And in fact, I just read an article that showed that when, is it Huxley, who's like Darwin's great sort of promoter? There was a Catholic thinker, it might've been a bishop, who immediately said, oh yeah, there's no problem with this. And Huxley was like, of course there is. You Christians need to have a problem with evolution. And the Catholic was like, really? I don't think so. You can read G.K. Chesterton, who's writing way before Humani Generis, where Pope Pius the 12th said, you know, it's legit to study this question from a Catholic point of view, and it's not forbidden. With respect to the evolution of the body, he reserves the soul doesn't evolve. That's important. Because it's not a material thing, and evolution applies to material things. But Chesterton says long before that that he can see no reason why a Catholic would have any problem with it. So it's this strange modernist version of God who's in the system and in competition with the elements of the system, who has problems with evolution, whereas the whole tradition actually finds it quite easy to accommodate, as many people saw at the time.
Right? I think a lot of the, and I mentioned this earlier. Actually, Alvin Plantinga mentions this also in God, Freedom, and Evil, that the problem of evil is fundamentally a pastoral problem, not a philosophical problem. Because, and this also maps onto my observation in watching Jordan Peterson talk to Sam Harris at the end of the first conversation that those two had on stage with Brett Weinstein sort of moderating between them. It became abundantly clear that they were talking about two different gods, and Sam Harris's God is completely within the system.
Right.
And now I've continued to work on this, and this does map onto some of Kaufman in a sense, because once God is in a system, in a sense, you've fully shifted over to the meta-divine realm. Because there will be a system above God towards which God must answer, and God is then in competition with all the other elements. God is now a God. Well, you know, one of the things that I noted, I've been wanting to do a video on this, but there's so many videos I want to do. A couple of years ago, I was reading Dallas Willard's Divine Conspiracy, and he made the comment about Jesus talking about this Kaiosune in the Sermon on the Mount. And of course, Dallas Willard was a professor of philosophy at USC, and he made the observation that, oh, this was a broader conversation going on, and you know, so he basically connected Plato's Republic with the Sermon on the Mount, and taught, saying they're dealing with similar things, and I'd never made that connection before, and so then I thought, oh, I should take a look at Plato's Republic. I'm gonna have to take a look at it in Greek, because you know I want to look for some of the word associations. And so I'm reading along in Plato's Republic in Greek, and I realize Plato's Republic is talking about the gods, and it talks about God. And it's like, wait a minute.
Right.
Plato is no monotheist. Or, right. Well, or where is that category coming from?
Right.
And so, you know, very much when we had our first conversation, God and the system, just lights start coming up in terms of my God number one and God number two. Because, you know, part of what makes Christianity, I was dealing with this in my school class, makes Christianity so tricky is that, you know, the God of the Bible is not just an impersonal meta-divine realm, but in fact has agency and will, which permeates down through. And we can see this in terms of primary and secondary causes. But then, of course, with the incarnation, God is both the agent and the arena in cognitive psychological terms, which we see that in the Old Testament with the angel of the Lord coming in. But obviously, magic is off the table in a system like that, whereas everything is about magic in the other system. And now, you know, then I was reading a la Jordan Peterson, The Metaphysical Club, which had a really significant passage that was talking about the fact that before Darwin, there were a lot of evolutionary theories about, you know, how the world emerges. And the real key thing about Darwin was, in fact, that, oh, now we can believe, which, of course, there's no way you could prove it one way or another. Now we can believe that there need not be an agent in this process. But again, when we get down into your system, God within the system, another strange quirk about our present system is that in our contemporary imaginary, we allow no agent higher than human beings, as if none others exist in the world. And that's an interesting jump, because how would we know? Who right. says? We actually have intersubjective agencies all over the place. We believe that, you know, Uncle Sam is an agent in our systems. I don't know what you have in Canada to compare with Uncle Sam. Go ahead.
I got a ton of ideas, but just to jump off that last one, it was really interesting. I read a book, The Emperor of All Maladies. Do you know this book?
No.
It's a book about cancer. It's a great book about cancer. The subtitle is, I might not get it exactly right, but it's a biography of cancer, or something like biography. And the author, who's a doctor, he's an oncologist, and a great writer, explains at some point in the book that he was going to call it a history of cancer or something like that. And at some point he felt like he was up against a personal reality in fighting cancer. And I was like, when he said that, I was like, that is not that far from what the New Testament means by powers and principalities.
That's right.
Right. That's a fascinating thing in itself, but to go to something you said about Sam Harris, his God that's in the system, right? You know, this atheist argument, I'm going to put it in quotes because it doesn't even strike me as a real argument, although I think at least some of them mean it sincerely. They say, well, look, to be an atheist, to not believe in Yahweh, is like everyone's an atheist about Zeus and Odin and whatever else, you know? And you just think you're being disingenuous. But if Yahweh is just one of the gods, then they're not being disingenuous. Although they, you know, someone like Dawkins has had this explained to him so many times, you start thinking like you're not being honest, because you can watch him in real time. There's actually a debate he has with Rowan Williams, former Archbishop of Canterbury, where Williams explains a Christian doctrine of God, and Dawkins just says, "Oh yeah, that's not what I mean by God." And then we're just like, "Well, that's end game then." It's like, why are we even having the rest of this conversation? But the point is, Sam Harris's God is derived directly from American popular debate about creationism.
Yeah.
And it's exactly right. And this is the image of God that the atheists throw back at us. And Thomas Aquinas would have been just baffled by this idea that you pointed out, right? That with Darwin, we got a mechanism now that explained the thing so well that we no longer need an agent. Thomas would have said, you didn't need an agent in that sense in the first place. For Thomas, because existence does not explain itself, anything going on within the system can be explained by things within the system, and that's not a problem. But you still have the question of why is there something rather than nothing? And saying that some things become other kinds of things, and we can show you a mechanism that's pretty compelling that you can actually watch in real time in a lab, you can see, you know, this process. That doesn't tell me why there's anything at all. Like, you've made a category mistake to think that evolution answers the question of God. But if Christians say, oh, we have to oppose evolution because it leads to atheism, you're just giving them the ammo to shoot you with. You know, like it's hard to watch, you know, and like when you read Thomas on this stuff or Augustine, it's clear how Thomas would have responded to this kind of thing, you know?
Well, and I'll have to look up that debate, but we've done, you know, so some of my conversations with John Vervaeke have very much been about this agency, because what we begin to realize is that we have all sorts of agents around us. I mean, you just mentioned cancer. If you look at, because of the whole Jordan Peterson thing and psychedelics, I read this very interesting book, How to Change Your Mind, on psychedelics.
Michael Pollan.
Yeah. And then we learned that, you know, there's a guy running around, I haven't read his book, who basically, you know, tries to explain human culture by the basis of, on the basis of fungi, you know, that fungi are beneath.
I read the book. I know.
Yeah. And it's like, and what you begin to realize is that there are in fact agents all over the place. And so that we sort of dismissively, you know, say, you know, no agents above us. And well, that seems rather convenient. And also rather, really rather silly because
right.
In terms of agents, we're pretty inconsistent limited. And unreliable.
Right. and in the ancient view, right? So we have a very flat metaphysics.
Yes.
Right. We don't imagine much above or below us. On the one hand, like we say strange things about how we're not any different than the animals, except that the animals would never have a debate about whether they're different from us. Like, you're right. Like, just there's a performative contradiction.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, we have this weird relationship with other creatures who are different than us. We try to erase the difference, and in erasing the difference, we show the difference. It's very weird. But then nothing above us. Whereas in the medieval and ancient metaphysics, it's very layered, right? So there's and humanity occupies this kind of middle spot. We're really interesting because we're rational animals. We're embodied souls. We're spiritual and physical, right? We're this interesting sort of connecting point, but we recognize both things like angels above and plants and animals and animals and plants and, you know, lower creatures, and then even inanimate objects below. And within that worldview, causality is often transcendent and not directly opposed, right? And we even see in the process of like digestion, right? Like you have plants that like turn like sunlight and water and dirt into nutrients that turn that animals can consume, that we can consume, that like you have this sort of this sense of the layeredness of reality that makes a lot of these things, in my mind, sort of more coherent. But when you have a super flattened metaphysics, all kinds of questions about meaning, right? The deeper things we want to talk about, whether it's things like the afterlife, things like creation, things like free will, all those kinds of questions, even a base, forget religion, what is justice?
Right.
That's a spiritual question. And if you have people who say like, every kind of question can be answered by the empirical methods of science. And you're like, well, what about whether this outcome of this trial was just or not, or unjust? And they're like, if we can't prove it by science, that doesn't mean anything. It just means we haven't figured out how to prove it by science yet. There's no recognition that there's a qualitative difference, that this is a different kind of question. And so then a whole series of questions get ruled off the table. They're just not questions, right? Question about the afterlife, question about creation. Well, that's just not a real question. So you'll see this response from some atheist commentators. It's like, well, that's a meaningless question. Well, that's weird, since most of humanity has asked it forever.
And hardly anybody acts as if it's a meaningless
question. And you can't live as if it's meaningless. Yeah. So what are you left with if the answer, you know, that an atheist materialist, you know, flat metaphysics gives you to the things that people really care about is, oh, that's that question only emerges as an epiphenomena of your bizarre, you know, neural structures. Like,
okay.
Even if that's true, you could never know it's true, because the only way you know anything is by your neural structures anyway, right? Like it's what they always accuse theists of. It's unfalsifiable. But they're pulling the same move, right?
Yeah.
But pretending that they're not.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And I think, you know, I should probably land the plane at some point here so we don't go forever. But, you know, one of the things, and this again is why so often to me when I'm having conversations with people about these things, it's a lot of it boils down to our capacity to trust. And we have this Discord server that's Bridges of Meaning that some people in my meetup have created. And I heard there was an Eric Weinstein server. And so I hopped into that and was overhearing some of that. And he said something which for me really distilled when I listened to others about why, you know, the resistance to the idea of the kind of God that we're talking about who is not in the system. Because quite frankly, such a God is terrifying when it comes to that agency versus ours, which if you'd sit back and think about it after a while, you'd say, yeah, but we deal with those terrors all the time. I've got the genetics that I've inherited from my parents. I've got the liabilities of my time and place of birth. I've got the, you know, all of the other things that are in the system that deeply impinge on me and my thought and everything I do and care about. He made the observation, and when he said it, I quick typed it out so I wouldn't lose it. You know, it's better if there is no God, because if there is a God, you have to worry about what's on his mind. And I thought, yeah, that's exactly right. Because that's why I think a lot of our reactivity to other agencies and agencies greater than our own is simply, you know, whistling in the dark and wishful thinking, because we're in terror of such an agency. And that terror gets trotted out in how many Hollywood movies when things come from the sky, aliens with greater technology, and on, and we find ourselves helpless before the power of others. And we very quickly recognize that they don't have our good fortune in mind or are committed to it, which of course sets up what we work in.
And you can make a valiant effort to avoid the most basic human questions, but they're coming back. I mean, the reason humans have told the stories they've told and engaged in the kinds of meaning making they've engaged in as long as they've been humans, you know, you can't tell those people that, you can't tell people in general that those are all meaningless and expect that vacuum to sit empty. If you empty that out, if you get rid of whatever, let's say you get rid of Christianity, you are not going to like what fills that vacuum. You know, there will be attempts at answering those questions, even by people who are telling themselves that those questions aren't meaningful. In fact, saying that they're not meaningful is part of your own meaning making. Yeah. Like, and the more self-deluded the meaning making is, I think that's one of the things that can make it more dangerous. But I mean, there's a lot of dangerous things out there. We talked in the last video about certain sort of poison kinds of nationalism. You know, I think in our crisis of meaning, that's one thing that's filling the vacuum, is political extremism and you know, different expressions that we see that are tearing communities apart. And people with eyes to see can recognize that, for all its faults, and the church has them, there's no doubt, it's been a remarkable force for stability, community, like all the kind of things that we take for granted as modern people, basics of morality, but like the equality and dignity of every human person, right? That didn't come from nowhere.
Yeah.
Right? That's part of a story that Christianity told the world. And that, to say that these kind of questions are meaningless, that, you know, people are going to find answers to those somewhere, you know, and it's naive to imagine that you can get rid of Christianity and things will just work out fine. Like, some of the other options available are not, you know, not what any of us are interested in, right? I mean, we can all read Nietzsche.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've killed a certain amount of time, And
okay, no and, complaints that this is too short.
No, no.
They'll all say this is exactly as long as it should have been.
We could go longer, but you've got a we're reaching the end of our days, and I've been doing this for about 5 hours today. So
yeah,
quite a bit of time sitting looking at this one screen. I'll post this sometime this week, and I don't know. We'll read the comments and see what folks think, and the conversations will continue.
Yeah, we'll see what the Vox Populi is.
Yeah. After. Well, and I'll drop that. I don't know what you're doing in September, but if you're able to get out to Thunder Bay, it might be an interesting conversation for you and meet some new people. You got seven kids though, and that's
yeah. Let's chat. I mean, Thunder. I am in Canada.
Yeah, just a small country.
Probably like an 18-hour drive or something. I don't even know. I don't know. I don't know how far it is. Maybe it's 12 hours. I don't know how far it is to drive to Thunder. It's a long ways.
Yeah.
Okay. Drive to Thunder Bay. But anyways, who knows? Let's chat.
All right. Good. Well, thank you, Brett. And again, real pleasure. Every time I talk to you, I just learn a ton. And that's a real gift to me. And thank you for the good work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. It's delightful to chat with you and to meet even some of your viewers via their comments and things. So it's been great to be part of this. You know, it's nice to see people engage with the ideas.
All right. So you take care, Brett.
Thanks, Paul. You too.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.